Tale of Two Kingdoms, Part 28. Good morning. Sorry about being late, but now what's that? The coffee whistle? Okay, half the class has departed for the tea machine. Okay. Last week we covered how Charles had begun his reign, how he was even more foolish than James, and that he had no sense of what his limitations were. Likely in part due to the fact that he was born in Scotland, but he didn't grow up there, didn't know the people. Probably in part due to the counsel of his father, taking it seriously. We look briefly at a revival in Scotland, at the rise of Arminianism in the English Church, and at attempts at forcing the Church of England worship form on the Church of Scotland. While I was getting ready for the class, I came across an extract of a letter. This was by Sir William Brereton, who apparently had traveled to Scotland. This was on... But this was a letter he wrote in 1636. In this kingdom, the clergy of late extend their authority and revenues. The Archbishop of St. Andrews is Lord Chancellor of Scotland and regent here. And as I was informed by some intelligent gentlemen, it is here thought and conceived that they will recover so much of that land and revenues belonging formerly to the abbeys, as that they will in a short time possess themselves of the third part of the kingdom. The Duke of Lennox and Marquis Hamilton are possessed of the largest proportion of church land. It is expected that they should resign and deliver up their interests and rights there into the church, whose example, it is thought, will induce the rest of the nobility to do the like. And to the end that they may carry some sway in Parliament, it is now endeavored to restore abbots and to invest them in the revenues and seats of abbeys. Hereof, they say there are 48 which are intended to be established, who are all to sit and carry voices in Parliament. Which, if it can be effected, then there will be always in the Parliament House so strong a party for the King, considering those officers that have an immediate dependence upon him, and the bishops and abbots, as that they will be able to sway the whole House. Okay, so, again, Charles is continuing this thing that we talked about with James, but getting the bishops, you know, and abbots, enough of a body in Parliament means you can always have your way. Okay. So Charles continued his interest in conforming the Church of Scotland to the Church of England. Actually, for several years now, they've been working on a book of liturgy and a book of church government. The Book of Canons, which is this book of church government, was available first. Charles personally reviewed it and ordered it to be printed in Aberdeen in 1636. It included such features as it affirmed that Charles was the head of the church and had absolute authority. Anyone who denied this was to be excommunicated. It reconfirmed the five articles of Perth, or reaffirmed them: kneeling at communion, private baptism, private communion, and so on. National synods were specified, but no meetings of presbyteries or sessions were allowed. And in fact, I guess there was no mention of the General Assembly. So, meeting in conventicles was prohibited. So, in other words, private, you know, prayer meetings and Bible studies and the like, worship services were prohibited. And pastors could not pray extemporaneously. If they did, they would be fired or deprived of their post. They had to only pray from the Book of Liturgy. It wasn't actually available yet, so they couldn't really enforce this provision at the beginning. But they were working on both of them. This one became available first. Okay, so during this same year, Samuel Rutherford, who I'm sure think most of you have probably heard of as the author of Lex Rex and a well-known Covenanter, he was at that time the minister of Anwath in southwest Scotland. He was called before a court of high commission, and he was sentenced to be deprived from his ministry. He was ordered to go to Aberdeen, where there were these... you'll see again and again, if I mention it, I may not, but that Aberdeen is the sort of one city that's very Episcopalian and holds out against all the Presbyterian form of church government, and they have the so-called Aberdeen Doctors. I guess there was a university there, but I haven't really paid close enough attention. Anyways, he was sentenced to go there, you know, apparently so he could come under their influence. But after he debated some of them, the so-called Aberdeen Doctors, they tried to have him sent further north to either Ork, it says, said to Orkney, I guess to the Orkney Islands, or Caithness, which is the very, very top of Scotland, the very farthest north part. It's a fairly desolate, I mean, at least today there's no trees or, you know, very few trees. It's mostly just sort of windswept grasslands. Okay, well, Charles had also commissioned this book of liturgy known as the Book of Common Prayer. A number of drafts were made by some of the Scottish bishops, and they were edited by Archbishop Laud. Apparently, the Scottish bishops tried to conform it somewhat to Scottish church practice, since they had an idea of what the Scots would actually take, or, you know, stomach. But Archbishop Laud tried to, you know, bring it closer to English practice. Let's see, Charles himself had ordered it to be, quote, as near to this of England as might be. And let's see, the editors slash authors of, I say editors, Dickinson and Donaldson put together a three-volume set called the Source Book of Scottish History, which isn't just, it's not just about ecclesiastical history, but a lot of the original documents I read from come from here. They pointed out that the making as close to England had two purposes. The other one, besides conforming the Scots church, was any changes they made for the Scottish version would give ammunition to the English Puritans who were fighting against the church there. So he's sort of between a rock and a hard place, as it were. Okay, in December of 1636, okay, let's see, the book is finally approved by Charles in April 1636, although apparently there were still some changes to be made. But in December, he issued a proclamation that every parish should obtain two copies of the prayer book. And since the book wasn't yet printed, there was some delay in actually using it. James King Hewison gives a description of the prayer book. I mean, some authors have said that in theology, it's fairly Calvinistic. But there were a number of innovations in worship, and so this is just a long paragraph from James Hewison King. The innovations were distasteful to many who could not approve of the celebrant of the Lord's Supper standing at an altar and presenting his side or back to the worshippers, from whom the rite was partly concealed, nor of dipping children in the font at the front door, which reminded them of a holy water vessel. The new terms, corporal for cloth, chalice for cup, Sunday for Sabbath, Patent for plate, presbyter for minister, gave needless offense. The commemoration on holy days, sport nightly according to a partial calendar, saints, Celtic missionaries, and others, all as dead as Pharaoh and some as nebulous as Orion, recalled the Roman festivals. The following instruction created alarm. Then the presbyter at baptism shall make a cross upon the child's forehead, saying, "We receive this child into the Church of Christ, and do sign him with the sign of the cross, in token that hereafter he shall not be ashamed to confess the faith of Christ crucified." Rowe, in his animated versions on the book, pointed out the Romanist significations in the communion. Right. The oblation of the elements before consecration, the consecrating prayer in these words, that these thy gifts and creatures of bread and wine may be unto us the body and blood of thy most dearly beloved Son, and the phrase partakers of the same his most precious body and blood, together with the kneeling posture, indicated the disguised doctrine of transubstantiation. That Laud, who regretted the omission of the oblation from the English liturgy, considered the celebration by the priest an offering as well as a memorial of Christ's precious death and sacrifice, is proved by his own notes in a copy of a prayer book. The suspicion of popery was increased by the permission of wafer bread, by the instruction to take the paten in his hand, not handle and break bread, and by the consumption of the residual elements in church by the communicants. The withholding of the sacrament, unless there was a sufficient number to communicate, violated the master spirit. The mince selections from Scripture and the Apocrypha, which were recommended to be sung, highly displeased others. Okay. Apocrypha. And the Scriptures, but they were mixed together.
Trent, not like the Council of Trent came out yet?
Yeah, Trent had come out sometime before.
And they prescribed that the Apocrypha was going to be incorporated in the Bible at that point, Catholic.
I tried to look into this, not that specific thing, but into the Council of Trent, and the website that I found it on was always down, so that's a good question, Mike.
I think the Council of Trent, they finally solidified that the Apocrypha was part of the Catholic.
Could very well be. That would fit, wouldn't it? So. Okay, well, interestingly, there'd been some delay due to printing and so on for the adoption of this liturgy in the Scottish churches. Some bishops had tried it in their own churches, but Easter of 1637 was set as the target date for universal adoption. Well, it came and went without it being used widely. Interesting enough, the trigger for it being used, you may find this humorous, the Archbishop of St. Andrews, Spotswood, and the Archbishop of Glasgow were in a struggle to obtain more lands and more rights to tithes, right? And that little thing from the letter that I read, you know, was talking about how these nobles were going to give up property and induce other ones to do likewise. Now, you could take a guess as to how the nobles felt about this, you know, giving up the lands that they had. So they were in a sort of struggle, and they wanted to go down and see the king directly, but they thought before they went they should be able to obtain a report of a good reception of this new liturgy before they went down there. So they decided they would introduce it on the 23rd of July, 1637. This was according to Hetherington, writing in the 19th century. According to Stevenson, there was also in Edinburgh the Court of Session, which was, I guess, what major legal court in the country was in session then, and it was going to be let out at the end of July. So he thought there was some thought that if there was news of a good reception, it would be broadcast throughout the country by all these people who had come to town for this court and then would return home back to their individual towns. So in either case, or in both cases, they attempted to introduce it on the 23rd of July in Edinburgh. At St. Giles Church, or Cathedral, there were two archbishops present, several bishops, members of the Privy Council, and the Dean of Edinburgh was to introduce the liturgy. And shortly after he started, according to common legend, a woman sitting near the front was reported to have yelled, "Villain, dost thou say mass at my lug?" In other words, are you saying mass in my ear? And she threw her creepy stool at him. Yeah, that's a little folding stool. So supposedly there was some reading of prayers before the main service, and some servant women would come in and set up a stool there, because they did not have pews, and then apparently their mistresses would come in later and sit down. And so she was sitting there with her stool and threw it at him. Okay, well, that triggered a big riot. Many objects available were hurled at the dean. He, if I remember right, he barely escaped with all his, didn't escape with all his clerical, you know, garments, the surplus and so on. The bishop waddled forward and tried to take control, and he stuff was thrown at him too. They were called them traitors, belly gods, and deceivers. Okay. They had the rioters ejected. The service was restarted, but some loud noises from the outside, breaking glass, battering doors, and yelling, were too distracting, so they stopped the service. Apparently at some other, at like Greyfriars Kirk, there was no violence, but there was a lot of anguish noises, and Hetherington speculates that if somebody had thrown something there, it would have went up in flames too. Okay, now, many of the exact facts of the incident are lost. The woman, she was reportedly an elderly servant woman named Jenny Geddes, although many historians claim she was the wife of John Mine, an Edinburgh merchant. Long time, he was a Presbyterian elder and had been involved in a number of Presbyterian struggles. Hetherington claims that it was definitely a spontaneous uprising, right? And he says, in support of this, he states that despite a concerted effort by the Edinburgh magistrates, they only arrested a few servant girls. At the same time, a number of the sort of royalist Episcopalian writers claimed it was a conspiracy. And some later writers believe this too, but there's no proof that it was, except for some of the Presbyterians had been previously meeting, and you know, it seems very likely that this was a planned response. But even Stevenson, writing recently, says, well, you know, perhaps it was planned, but it wasn't planned that it would go up like this with people throwing stuff. So. Okay, this riot, as you might imagine, provoked people in different ways. The two archbishops attempted to crack down on ministers with, you know, the sort of Presbyterian sympathetic ministers by ordering they must buy and use within 15 days the liturgy book, or they would be technically charged with rebellion, put to the horn. I guess the ones with strong Presbyterian sympathies would be those who had not yet bought the liturgy book. Several of these, including Alexander Henderson, submitted a petition to the Privy Council to suspend the order. The petitions were supported by letters from a number of the nobles and gentry, and his petition made several points, including the fact that the Book of Common Prayer had not been approved by the General Assembly and the Scots Parliament, as their form of worship previously had been. So the Privy Council, meeting on the 25th of August, 1637, they waffled. They determined that the order, previous order, technically only applied to buying the book, but they didn't have a technical order to use it. So the charge of rebellion was dismissed, in effect. Henderson himself said he wouldn't mind buying the book to read it to find out what was wrong with it, but he refused to use it. They've had some. I don't know directly before. I mean, the articles of Perth specified certain things. They had had a book that they, I guess some things were done from, but I couldn't tell you sort of the extent of it and how different everything was in here. I think some commentators basically said that in effect this was a this is sort of the last straw in incremental series of changes. But, you know, in and of itself, this wasn't that revolutionary, but it was just sort of the last straw. So, well, maybe. I mean, actually, this, not to digress, but I will anyways, this week several things came to mind about this whole issue of incrementalism. One, I was reading in Stevenson, which is I think this was written in the 70s, so he's a modern, oh, I guess I didn't bring it. He's a modern writer, present day, and he was commenting basically that this uprising that we see goes a lot further than the ministers would have gone. He said the ministers were much more moderate than the nobles and so on, and they would have been willing to continue to accept bishops and so on. I'm thinking to myself, well, of course they would. All the real hardliners were gotten rid of by, you know, have been gotten rid of by James and so on over time. Again, it's an incremental approach. And at the end, you know, this modern historian seems to just, you know, I mean, he makes it sound like, well, you know, the ministers weren't that extreme. And I'm thinking, well, of course, the extreme ones at all, you know, had been thrown in the tower or, you know, exiled or whatever. And, you know, they'd been 30 years of persecution and harassment. Or, you know, something like that. I mean, depending on how you count. But so, I also saw in the news yesterday that our president has now proposed this Help with the Family Leave Act, and so that now he's encouraging states to pay unemployment benefits to people who take family leave, like when a baby is born. This doesn't really. It doesn't really have anything to do with our class, but in terms of an incremental strategy, so you couldn't get that at the beginning. So first, they just passed a Family Leave Act that allowed family leave, but with no financial repercussions. The company wasn't obligated to, you know, pay you while you were taking family leave, right? Now you can see, well, we've gone along a few years. That was accepted. Very few people took it. Now we'll just ratchet up a little bit
You know, you can probably see eventually where the strategy is going. You know, to, but I don't know. That's really neither here nor there in terms of the class. But it just—I was reading that and it just hit me that this is. If you think about the initial act, it was just such a small step that you could, you know, companies over a certain size had to give a certain amount of family leave, but unpaid. You know, so. Okay, it was a hassle for the company, but there wasn't a big financial loss, and not very many people would take it for that reason. As for me and my house, though, you know, a year of paid leave given, you know, at the time to the husband at the time of the birth of the baby, is just too late. It should have come, you know, 10 years ago. I wouldn't have to work. Yeah, think of my brother, okay. They do have this in Sweden. So, but we have a colleague who's taken like a year, you know, took a year off once, and I think he built a house, is what he did actually during the time. But. Okay. So the Privy Council had waffled on this. They then made a report to the king, and in past, I think they tended. What the king was doing is he was sending orders up and assuming they were obeyed, you know, had no idea what was really happening. I mean, if he heard about this sort of unhappiness, he, you know, apparently put it down to being just a few recalcitrants that were, you know, hard to please. So they made a report to the king. They told him the truth about how widespread the dissatisfaction was with the new Book of Common Prayer. And they planned to meet again on the 20th of September to hear his response. Okay, let's see. At this point, according to Hetherington, the prelates were exceedingly disappointed and enraged by these proceedings of the council. They now saw themselves deserted by the nobility, and they never had possessed the support of the people. The prelates, the bishops. So, because basically the Privy Council waffled, they were, and you'll see what you'll see as time goes on. Even people like even the guy who had prosecuted this Balmerino. He gets very half-hearted about enforcing the king's wishes and stuff. And, you know, I mean, he doesn't go over to the other side, but he tries to be sort of reasonably peaceable, do everything as half-hearted as possible. Okay, so they used their influence with Laud in England, who, you know, used his influence with the king to encourage a very sharp reply to the council. And he did issue a very sharp reply. He told the council they had to remain in Edinburgh, or at least a committee did have to remain in Edinburgh until the liturgy was established, that all magistrates selected for the burghs, the important towns, must conform to the new liturgy, and the bishops must read their liturgy in their own churches. Right? So, again, we note that the king could have taken a more conciliatory course, but he didn't. Interestingly enough, one bishop took this command to heart. And this is a contemporary account. To this last command, the Bishop of Brechin yielded a singular compliance. He armed himself with pistols, and taking his own family, all likewise armed, to church before the people were assembled, fastened the doors, and so read the liturgy in triumph.
So, you know.
Out. he had his family there. They listened to it. Okay, well, the king's response didn't have the quite the outcome that he intended. At this point, the resistance really started to organize. So within 3 days, a significant number of nobles and barons, about 100 ministers, representatives from 66 parishes, representative burghs and gentry from the southern counties of Scotland, arrived in Edinburgh. They decided to send a joint petition back to the king, as he thought he had been misinformed and... you know, they always give the king sort of the benefit of the doubt. The petition was received by the king, and the answer was returned on the 17th of October. They attempted to keep it secret, but word got out, and a number of people again rushed to Edinburgh to hear the outcome. And with them, they had several hundred local petitions. And the resistance at this point was getting so large, they couldn't all meet together, so they split up into nobles, lairds, burgesses, and ministers and met separately. The king's letter had a few surprises. He hadn't changed his mind, but he did make a number of orders about what should be done. First of all, the Privy Council was to take no further action on the affairs of the church, so there were to be no more petitions. All those who had gathered in Edinburgh were to disperse within 24 hours. He ordered that the Privy Council and Court of Session be moved to Linlithgow, and then it was supposed to be moved to Dundee. And he also ordered George Gillespie's book, A Dispute Against the English Popish Ceremonies, to be surrendered and burned. So, the people that were present, the sort of resistance, as it were, drew up a new supplication the next day, another query to the king. This time, though, instead of the ministers taking the lead, the nobles took the lead. They were quite infuriated at the king's treatment of them. And I've only found a piece of the supplication, but according to Stevenson, the whole thing went beyond the Book of Common Prayer. It also rejected the Book of Canons and the bishops. So, in fact, this is, I think, where Stevenson was saying that the ministers had been quite happy to keep these other things. But okay, it was this supplication was signed by 30 nobles, 281 lairds, 48 burgesses, and 123 ministers. So they had something like a... Evelyn, quick, how many names is that? Yeah, 480-something, I think is what they said. In mid-November, the supplicants decided to form a representative convention of the nobles, lairds, burgesses, and ministers, as it might be called a convention of estates. If you remember, the Scottish Parliament was made up of the nobles, the burgesses or burghers, the representatives of the burghs and the ministers. This was like an alternative parliament.
I slipped on it. What exactly were they asking for?
Their complaint went beyond the Book of Common Prayer. It went to the Book of Canons and bishops. So they were wanting to get...
Jettison the Book of Common Prayer. Jettison the bishops and the canons. All three out.
Yep.
They were not implemented.
They were. They just had bigger increments. Mike?
What was the motive that caused them to go so hardcore?
It was the king's... Every time they sent a petition to the king, he came back with basically the same answer.
So they just kept going. They just kept...
Yeah, they kept ratcheting it up. And he actually ratcheted up each time with, you know, additional things, like moving the Privy Council out of Edinburgh. It's like this threat, you know, you're not going to be the capital anymore. So, in fact, that was kind of ironic later because actually the Privy Council was they should have been in Edinburgh so they could keep tabs on things, and they had to send like commissions to Edinburgh to keep tabs on things. Like
Charles, understand that really this is like a shot across the bow. In fact, I mean, it was so radical difference there. The only thing that could happen was some sort of revolution.
Now, well, we're going to get to the bishops' wars will be coming shortly. So, yeah, he. No, I don't. Well, I mean, this is my interpretation. Is he was. He was under the influence of like Archbishop Laud, and he either was misinformed or he didn't want to hear the truth, you know. And these bishops kept telling him that it was only, you know, a few whiners that were complaining. And but I mean, at this point, once he got this petition, I mean, this should have been, you know, the clarion cry that something's wrong. I mean, there's a lot of these aren't peasants, of course. These are a lot of, you know, influential people that are writing and saying, you know, you've gone too far.
And their minds, so to speak. I mean, all the hardcore guys.
Right. So there's still 123 ministers that signed it even after. Now, there were still some, like, I mean, Samuel Rutherford was a minister. There were still some good ministers in the church that had squeezed through various ways. But they met this convention. They met on a number of occasions, sort of plan their strategy, and in mid-December they chose five lawyers to advise them on how to proceed. And what they wanted to do was proceed against the courts of high commission, which they thought were illegal, and perhaps the bishops. And in fact, they were even getting advice at this point from the king's advocate, the king's attorney there, on what they could do. So on the 21st of December, they submitted a declinature, a formal declaration of the refusal to submit to the bishops as members of the council, because the bishops were acting as judges in matters in which they had a vested interest in. And they also submitted a petition formally complaining against the way that their previous petitions had been treated, i.e. basically ignored. So the king was finally convinced he needed to take the matter somewhat seriously. He summoned his senior civil servant, the Earl of Traquair, who was a treasurer. Remember, his chancellor was Archbishop Spotswood, but I get, you know, differentiating between the two. He called Traquair to London. Traquair's advice to the king, and again, this had been the guy who was the lead prosecutor against Balmoreno and got the death sentence, was that the king should compromise and, you know, be conciliatory and try to get things back on an even keel. The bishops gave different advice. Don't compromise. And that's why these are called the bishops. The battles that they get into are called the bishops' wars. He took the bishop's advice, but interestingly, Charles had one sort of characteristic is his servants would tell him that they disagreed with his policies or whatever, and he would say, no, do this, and then he would send them back. You know, if you can imagine our president, for example, you know, his Secretary of Defense or something telling him, you know, we've got to do X, Y, and Z, and he says, no, we're going to do A, B, and C, and, you know, continually, but keeps expecting this guy to do his will, as it were, when, you know, he advised you against it. So he sent him back to Scotland. By the time he had gotten back, word had already reached, tried to keep it a secret, but word basically reached Edinburgh what the main points of the king's proclamation were. Okay, this time he didn't give any hope to the supplicants, whereas before they would always say, well, you know, perhaps you've been misadvised, in effect, you know, these people have misinformed you. He took responsibility for the prayer book himself, said that he had personally reviewed it, and which I believe he had actually personally reviewed it, but they'd always given him the benefit of the doubt. His only offer that he made to them was one of amnesty. If they gave up and went home, then he would forget about their past offenses. But any meetings in the future were banned as treasonous. So the supplicants were faced with a dilemma. Basically, all legal means had been exhausted for petitioning. And in effect, all legal means in the future had been denied. Well, they went ahead and met on the 23rd of February anyways, and they decided to go a step further. They decided to make a band or covenant based on the king's confession of faith from 1581. I say based on. They incorporated it and expanded it. And that is the National Covenant, which we'll cover next time. But by way of perspective on the king, Archibald Johnston of Warrenston was one of the... he was a lawyer. He was one of the Covenanter's advisors. He was a Covenanter. And he wrote, this was this is from his diary. He wrote about, not so much about the king, but what the church had been faced with. And he said, "The Lord has led us hitherto by the hand from step to step. And at every step we would have stood at," in other words, every step, place that we would have stopped at, "made our adversaries to refuse and force us to go up a new step of reformation. So even yet in this business, he will not suffer any manner of composition or condescendence till he bring us to the highest step of reformation. And instead of those cautions and limitations of prelates now contained in our articles, suffer us not to settle till we speak plain truth according to the will of God, that is, the utter overthrow and ruin of episcopacy, the great grandmother of all our corruptions, innovations, usurpations, diseases, and troubles." So, like the pharaoh of old who would not compromise, God had hardened Charles' heart, and this was the sort of outcome. You know, when he would always say no to every step, it would be ratcheted forward. Okay, so next time we'll go over the National Covenant and the signing of it and whatnot. Questions? Vicki. Was she from America? Okay. But she didn't have a stool with her. Okay.
Well, yeah. I have a more serious question along this line. From our perspective, just with this example, how do you separate sort of the wheat from the chaff in these cases? You know, you have. Clearly, just to say something's too popish is ridiculous. I mean, what does that mean?
The context of what's coming up in the Protestant history, where they have covenants with the people, and the last religion came to act in a more
but has got to be more substance there than this just reminds me of. Oh yeah, and I understand. I mean, I understand why they were insistent on throwing, you know, every. They wouldn't bend even a little bit, and rightly so. But from the perspective of being under no pressure at all, I mean, they were fighting a king who was bound and determined to take over the church. But nobody's trying to take over the archangel. And so we can say its hand is too potent. No, what does it mean? That its hand is too potent. I mean, you know, is it? You see what I'm saying? But I think
don't ask me to speak to anything that happened in the last 5 years.
but I think that this is it can be a dangerous attitude where something just strikes you the wrong way, or in your mind it's associated with a past experience that it was a bad experience from your previous life in the Catholic Church where it brings up these memories. But the question is, should you work through that, or and then try to separate what's true from what's substantial from what's not, or should you just go to the lowest common denominator, which means that absolutely everything that reminds anybody of any of their past bad experiences or
wandering
in apostate church.
Mike.
No. Okay. But see, I think that...
Well, I'm not going to answer his question. I'm just going to let him...
But I think that when you have people, it seems like it overthrows the Presbyterian form of government. When you have people just saying, no, we're not going to do that. Get out of here.
The elders
should say, no, this is okay. This is wrong.
Yeah. Well, speaking of Jenny Geddes, of course, the Presbyterian form of church government had been overthrown already, so she didn't really have that option.
Yeah. Mike. Well, the issue that I'm thinking about here is, obviously, you know, if Charles said he was in the church, he had probably the idea that he was God's anointed.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely.
Okay. Then wouldn't that really be looked at as these folks who players and trying to work their God? I mean, how do these folks think through these things? The fact that they had to, for me to take and go against what Cain had said, I would have to show that what he was doing is asking to do things directly against what God had said.
Yeah, well, next week we'll look at this national covenant, which goes on and on with the sort of reasoning of how they got to where they're at. And it's not...
Yeah. It's time to look at this one.
Did they have Lex Rexy this time, or not?
I don't think so. I don't think they had Lex Rexy yet, although it's very... It comes about right about this time. I'm going to have to look and see. I don't know if he was part of writing it or not. I'm not sure. Let's see, at this time he was still banished to Aberdeen. Now when this all started erupting, a lot of these ministers went home, back to wherever they were, you know. But I have to look and see if he was part of it or not. But certain other sort of like-thinking individuals that were part of it. So. But, well, they basically rejected the king, you know, the king as ruler of the church, Christ as ruler of the church. So.
Well, since they don't reject him, in some sense, they rejected the idea that
Yeah, in the sense that he was anointed to be the head of the church, they certainly rejected that. But they didn't completely reject the idea that he was, say, anointed to be king, as it were. So.
Obviously, rejected the idea of the rest of his house.
Yeah, to extend to the church, right? To extend to the other kingdoms. See, Mike, would you close us in prayer?